FU Network. Yeah, it's about an attitude, but FU stands for us. Us, regular people, making the type of authentic, honest, down-to-earth programming that big media stomped out of existence. Well, our message to big media is FU. Come on, join the team. Reclaim our media for the common people. Become a supporter for $5 a month via Patreon or PayPal. Patreon.com/FU Network TV or PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. That's Patreon.com/FU Network TV or PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Come on, $5 a month? That's $1.50 a week to rebuild real Canadian media. You drop more than that every day on overpriced coffee. Yeah, you do. So if you like our podcasts, tell big media FU and cough up a fin. Now, here's your show.
From Fun, the FU Network, this is We've Got Issues. And here's today's hosts, Ishat Reza and Neil Wadewich.
Ishat, it's great to be speaking with you again. It's great to be back behind the mic.
I'm glad that we have this opportunity to do a podcast on the issue of WE and the Canada Student Service Grant that is a program that got derailed because there were some questions around using the WE charity in delivering this program. And I'm sure everyone who's listening has gotten some information around this, so we don't need to give too much of a background on what that issue is. What we thought would be helpful is actually just to kind of go through different aspects of this issue that has completely blown up, and in my view has been blown out of proportion. But there are some valid things to be looking at and considering. So I think we could touch on that as well as, you know, kind of a bit of the context, look at some of the misrepresentations and ultimately what the consequences have been over the last little while as a result of the derailing of this program.
And also what some of the consequences going forward are going to be, not just for WE themselves, but, I mean, how WE view the current Liberal government, how WE view the opposition, and the relevance to a lot of the points that have been brought up. I feel this conversation, this so-called scandal, have veered well beyond what is politically relevant in Canada. And I feel that there are other things at play. So it's good to kind of get into the nuts and bolts of it with you.
Mm-hmm. So where do you want to start?
Well, I mean, I think that when we're discussing WE and what WE does, it seems like I heard Amanda Alvaro say it the other night on Power and Politics that it's almost like the McDonald's of charities, right? They're in every school. My daughter has had connections with them, that they help run volunteer programs in Ontario schools, that they build schools abroad, that they've impacted a number of lives. And I think that one of the things that are being lost throughout this entire conversation, throughout this entire issue, is that it's almost being played in Canadian media that WE has no value, that they hold no value, that it's a shell company, not a charity. And I hate to see some of the good work that they've done being lost through this, but I know we're going to discuss.
Actually, on WE, I mean, you know, I'm not an expert on the organization, but what I do know is, yeah, it had a very well-known reputation both in Canada and overseas. They've been around for 25 years. They were founded by these two brothers, Craig and Mark Kielberger, who were teenagers at the time that they started doing this work. They had a different name before, and then over the years they've changed. They have a pretty complex complex structure to the charity that has a number of different wings. Now, one of them is the me-to-we part, which is actually the profit-making side of things. But the majority of the work that they're doing is in the service of other people. So it is a charitable organization. And actually, I think it's a good point to make that, you know, the reason the government actually went to them was because they had a need to deliver a student service, like a volunteering kind of initiative. That was the policy decision on the part of the government. They wanted to be able to give students an opportunity to volunteer during this pandemic period because a lot of jobs had dried up. And in order to do that, you know, they needed to figure out, well, how can we do this? Now, one thing that I think people need to be clear on is that when the political side decides that they want to fund a particular type of initiative, they will go to the Minister of Finance and say, okay, we want to do this kind of an initiative. What kind of money can you set aside? I mean, sometimes it can also be that the Ministry of Finance or Department of Finance, as they're doing their work on, you know, how to respond to the pandemic, they can do the diligence. And what we learned from Katie Telford's testimony is that Bill Morneau had shared with the Prime Minister I think it was April, early April, that there were some gaps in terms of groups of Canadians who were affected by the pandemic, who hadn't yet had an opportunity that the government hadn't had an opportunity to roll out much programming for them, and that they were looking at ways to do that. So the idea did come from that initiative of the government responding to various groups through the pandemic. And then what they do is they turn it over to the civil servants to do the groundwork on, okay, well, we want to have some kind of a program that involves student service, go figure it out, right? And that's what the job is of the civil servants. Like, the interesting thing in a lot of the discussion in the media and, among politicians and pundits and so on is they seem to think that the political side is responsible for any and every aspect of what's going on within the government. And while the political people, the cabinet, and including, you know, the Prime Minister, is responsible for decision making, they're not the ones who do all of the work. The civil service is there. The federal public service is around 300,000 people across this country who are responsible for various things, from policy side of things to operational delivery, to supporting in various roles. They have, you know, there are a lot of things that government does, and really it's the public servants who deliver a lot of the work at the direction, obviously, in terms of high level direction and approval of the elected officials. But it is the public service that ultimately does the work. And in this case, what we've learned from the testimony of five senior civil servants is that they were tasked within a period of 3 weeks to come up with a student service program for students. And in doing that, what they had done in April was they had initiated contact with about a dozen volunteer organizations or charitable organizations to see if they had a capacity to deliver some kind of programming. It was general, from what we understand, of the kinds of discussions that they had. And then in addition, because, you know, the government has been working with many different organizations, they within the government had a sense of, you know, the kinds of things that, that these organizations can deliver. So in April, they made their assessment of, well, who do we think is best placed? Some of it involved conversations with these organizations. Some of that involved just them discussing amongst themselves as to the capacity and coming up with the idea. They ultimately decided that WE was the organization that was best placed to deliver this type of an initiative in the timelines, that were required, which were pretty tight. The other thing that we learned from the testimony of the official from the Department of Finance, Michelle Kovacevic, is that they initially had thought that the Canada Service Corps would have been a good organization to try to deliver this. But when they went to the Canada Service Corps, what they came back with was a proposal that was not sufficiently ambitious enough. They weren't able to get as many placements. And in part, that's because they were stretched in other ways and delivering other programs. And so when they were doing their outreach and so on, they decided, well, maybe WE would be a better organization. The official from ESDC, which is the Department Employment Skills Development Canada, that is where Rachel Wernick works. She's a senior assistant deputy minister, which is very senior. She obviously has a big team that works with her. It was Rachel Wernick herself who reached out to WE to discuss the possibility of and the concept of a student service program. So this is all in the context of, you know, WE was themselves, as we learned from the Kielbergers' testimony, going through some some issues because of the pandemic, you know, and WE days and things like that being canceled now and schools being off and so on. So they were in a downsizing kind of mode. But at the same time, they were still operating, and they had pitched in early April a proposal to the government on a student entrepreneurship program. And that is not unusual. That's normal for organizations outside of government to pitch all kinds of ideas and programs to the government. The government, when they get it, usually the political side people, they'll flip it to their officials, which are the public servants, to review, and, you know, they give recommendations of what do we think we should do with this. That entrepreneurship proposal didn't end up going anywhere. The government didn't want to go in that direction. So instead, what we learned is that at the, you know, it just happened to be concurrently, but it was not related, that the officials at ESDC were looking at, well, maybe WE could help us. So on April the 19th, Rachel Wernick reached out to WE to ask about the concept of this kind of a program. But they still hadn't decided on who they thought would be good to deliver this. A few days later, on the 22nd, the government announced a $9 billion initiative for students, a series of initiatives in this package that included, you know, a bunch of things, like including the emergency student benefit, doubling of the Canada Student Grant. Also, they had some deferral issues around student loans. And then, you know, they also extended scholarships and postdoc fellowships and things like that as part of this $9 billion. And in addition, this Canada Student Service Grant was announced, but they didn't announce any details around it, because what we learned subsequently in the testimony is that they actually didn't even know how they were going to deliver it. So they had assigned $912 billion for this program. It was an envelope of money, and they were still working out the details of, well, how exactly are they going to deliver it? So at that, on that date, the government didn't even say anything about WE or anything, because they didn't even know. And what we also learned in the testimony was, a couple of days later, officials from the Department of Finance and from ESDC spoke with WE just to learn a little bit more on their ability to deliver, again, on a volunteer program, this similar to the student service announcement that had gone forward, but no commitments had been made as to whether they were going to go with this organization or not, and so on. So, you know, what we learn is that this whole idea was done in the context of a whole myriad of programs that the government was pulling together. There were around 70 initiatives that had been announced over the, you know, first couple of months after the pandemic hit. And this is just one of many, 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 many programs. So I know I've just been going on. I don't know if you want to interject at this point, or if you want me to continue.
I mean, Isha, isn't this one of the pitfalls, though, of when you find yourself in unprecedented times and you're kind of making policy on the fly? I mean, of course, it's not that simple. I'm making kind of a generalization here, but isn't this one of the pitfalls of finding yourself in a situation where you have to think outside of the box?
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing to keep in mind is that, you know, normally when governments initiate or announce programs, we're talking about 6 to 8 months worth of work in the lead up to these kinds of announcements. Like, normally they have, you know, more time, significantly more time, not just the 3 weeks that these officials were given, come up with something, you know, for students. Like, that is like such an insanely compressed amount of time. And, you know, like, I worked in government for a decade, and I was there in the post 9/11 period. And, you know, we had to react pretty quickly on transportation related issues. And I was in I was overseeing transportation departments in the Treasury Board at the time. So, like, I was in the middle of the response that we did during that emergency. But I got to tell you, even then, we had months to come up with stuff. We didn't just deliver in weeks. Like, to do it in weeks, honestly, I don't know how it is for them. I mean, what I've heard, you know, from some people who are involved in the response right now is they've been working 18 to 20 hour days, and they've been doing this for a few months. They are churning stuff out, like, at a pace that we have not seen in this country in our lifetimes, right? So I think we need to keep that context in mind. And I think just in, you know, my review of everything, all of the work that the government has done, and let's remember that they too are dealing with the pandemic, right? So they are also working from home. They also have their kids at home. They have their pets in their background when they're doing their work. You know, like, they're dealing with a really difficult circumstances right now in delivering all these initiatives. And, you know, I just feel like the response and the kind of critique, a lot of it has just been really unfair and not taking into consideration just how challenging things are right now for those in government. And they've done a lot. I mean, they delivered the CERB in record amounts of time. They managed to use the CRA platform super efficiently. Like, that went off without a hitch, which is incredible. You know, they did the wage subsidy thing and there was a bit of slow uptake, but then the government amended things so then there could be more organizations that qualify for it. You know, they have been doing a ton of things that has really helped us economically. They've also been obviously dealing with the, you know, the health side of it, dealing with provinces and territories. The fact that they've been having weekly meetings with the provinces and territories, that's an incredible way of collaborating. I mean, it shows good collaboration across this country from all levels of government. I'm not just saying the federal government, like even from municipalities, even the provinces, even though we've had some challenges with provinces, and not to say that we've had a perfect response, but we've had a very good response now, from our governments, right?
Now, would you like, so there's obviously a dissonance between the reality of what it took to unroll these programs and what the public perceives them to be. And where do you think the failure in that lies? Is that a failure of media? Is that a failure in communications of the government to kind of explain how difficult that this isn't something that we've been able to hear, like to have you explain that, to watch Amanda Alvaro explain that and other people explain how much work was put into this, hear Katie Telford say it. This isn't stuff that's being brought up. It's not stuff that's being communicated to the Canadian public, who I think that would be an important piece of information to hear.
To be honest, I think much of the responsibility does lie with the media, because it is their job to investigate things, to look at the criticisms that are being lobbed, but also to look at the counter side of things and to be able to contextualize things in an informed way. And I think that's where they've really fallen down. Like, there's just been such a huge misunderstanding about how government operates. And I do think that those who are responsible for reporting on government issues in Ottawa need to know how Ottawa functions, right? Like, they need to have a good understanding. There's no excuse for that. So I do think in a large part, it does fall on the media to properly explain things, to make sure there's good context. I mean, they've had so many misleading titles. For the longest time, everyone was talking about a $900 billion sole source contract. And it's like, no, it's not a sole source contract. When you talk about sole source contracts, that has to do with government procurement. When government procures goods and services, this was not about procuring any good or service for the government. This was about a program that the government wanted to use a third party to deliver, which is why they used a contribution agreement. And contribution agreements fall under the transfer payment policy, not the government procurement policies. So to me, that's just such a basic distinction. And I made some of those comments on social media, and I did get some blowback from certain journalists saying, oh, well, yeah, I'd like to see the government, you know, respond as like, let that be their defense of how things have gone so poorly. And it's like, no, you have to report the facts accurately. And if you're going to evaluate whether the government did a good job in rolling out this program, you should be using the correct regime to evaluate it. Don't evaluate a contribution program under the government procurement regime, because they're not the same thing. You know, it's not relevant. So, you know, anyway, so through the testimony, we also learned on that under a contribution agreement, there's no obligation to go with a bidding process to figure out who you're going to be, you know, using to partner with. But sometimes you can. But what the officials explained is that there was not enough time. Normally, those bidding process competitions take a minimum of 2 to 3 months. They didn't have that time. They had to deliver this program. They were told, you have 3 weeks to design it. We want to get this up and running. I mean, these were discussions in April. Students were going to be done university and college in May. So they wanted to be able to have a program up and running in sort of the late May to early June timeframe. That did not give an opportunity for there to be a bidding competition, especially it made no sense when the officials themselves had done their analysis and they decided and assessed that we was the best candidate to go forward with. So, you know, When it comes to contribution agreements, you know, we've done it in the past. So, for example, when there was the fires and the flooding and so on out in Alberta, you know, the government gave money to the Red Cross to deal with stuff, right? They didn't do a big bidding competition at the time. It's like, no, you have an urgent need and you go and you know, get it done. Like, we want governments to be efficient and effective, right? And also to be careful. Like, obviously, we don't want them to be like favoring organizations. But in this case, there's no evidence at all of any kind of favoritism. Instead, what we see, it was the public servants who did their job in assessing that this was the right organization to partner with. And I would say that, you know, for all of the detractors of WE, and, you know, I'm not going to comment on all of the potential issues with the organization and their various ways and complaints against it, because, like, I don't have the context. And also, it's kind of irrelevant to whether they were well placed to deliver this particular program. And we have evidence that in the month or so that they were working on this initiative, they actually did a very good job in getting the program up and running. They found 24,000 placements, partnering with 83 not-for-profit organizations. 35,000 students already had applied for this program. That's not a small number, 35,000. And of those 35,000, 64% of them were visible minority students, 10% identified as LGBTQ students. So to me, that shows that this program was off to a good start, that we in fact did have the capacity to get this program started, to onboard these students. I mean, they really had pulled together a good team to be able to get things going. And it's a shame that the whole thing got derailed. Now, I am a little bit irritated with WE for having backed out, because that seems like that's what they did when, you know, all these unfair criticisms were being lobbed about. I understand why they did it. It was sort of, they were trying to deal with the reputational damage, but you know, I don't think it's worked, because now they've had all these sponsors pull out, you know, because they've been listening to all the you know, the overblown hype around it. But the thing is, like, it was off to a great start, and it would have been great if they could have done it, because all these students, you know, were in the process of being considered for these placements. They probably would have been able to have a very interesting summer experience with these 83 organizations and growing. I mean, they were still looking for more placements. So, you know, it is such a shame that a program that was designed to help not-for-profits and help students ended up getting derailed.
But that's not how it's being reported. And therein lies one of my major frustrations, is that the numbers that you just read out, the amount of people that it was going to help, the amount of organizations, not only that, but the demographic of who had applied and who would have been, you know, given this opportunity.
Right, because one of the objectives of the program that the government had stated was they wanted to make sure that there was a diversity and inclusion focus, so that we were giving opportunities to those students who, you know, ordinarily have a harder time getting opportunities.
But that's not what's being reported, though, is it?
Of course not. It's being called, which is terrible.
It's being called a billion-dollar bailout. It's being called...
Exactly.
It's, you know, giving $1 billion to the friends of Prime Minister Trudeau. And I think that is, I hate to continually beat up on the media, because it seems to be a focus of kind of calling out some of the hypocrisy that I see. But I think the failure in Canadian media to explain this story adequately is going to be something that is, I find, is going to be one of the lessons that we learn from this. And
I hope it's a lesson that can be learned. But actually, on that point that you just made about the billion-dollar bailout and the friends of Trudeau and so on, let's also just clarify the why those statements are factually wrong. So first of all, the $912 million program envelope, what we learned through looking at the evidence, which included the contribution agreement, is that actually it was going to be a $500 million program of grants up to that amount flowing to students. And then there was an additional $43.5 million allocated to reimburse WE and other not-for-profits that incurred costs as part of administering and delivering this program. So that $43.5 million wasn't even meant for WE by itself. It was only for costs associated with so eligible expenditures, which were detailed as to what qualified as an eligible expenditure. They had to be reasonable, and there were a bunch of other criteria written into the contribution agreement. So that's what would have gone to the organization. So it's a far cry from $1 billion. And even then, it's not like it was a freebie to the organization to do with as they wish. No, it was only for eligible expenditures under the contribution agreement. And any amounts that were not spent that were eligible expenditures or were not given to students as grants came back to the government. So there, the governance side of this actually didn't really have many risks associated from the perspective of taxpayer money, especially because there was ongoing active monitoring requirements. There was biweekly reporting that was required. There were provisions for follow-up audits and evaluations for a number of years after the program ended. Those are all very standard in contribution agreements, except for the biweekly reporting. That is not always in the case. That is not always usually the case, but it just goes to show that they were actually setting it up with really good oversight mechanisms, right? And in part, we learned from the Prime Minister's testimony, one of the reasons that they also had, that they were only going to allow certain amounts of money to flow at, you know, certain times, like there was tranches of money that was going to flow to the organizations for expenditures, was because the PM himself had said that, you know, there's a lot of money. So we want to make sure that, you know, we're not just handing it all over at once, let the money flow in tranches. And then you see that detailed in the contribution agreement. So the point is, what we see from the perspective of the government, both the civil servants, but also from the political side, is that they were being very careful about this. The clerk of the Privy Council testified that his instructions from the chief of staff to the Prime Minister, Katie Telford, was that to use make sure there's scrutiny and a lot of care in how they proceed with this. And that, again, suggests the government was trying to be very careful in how they proceeded with this initiative, that they wanted to make sure that it was going to be successful, that the objectives were going to be met, and that there wasn't going to be any kind of waste of money or any kind of oversights that happened on this initiative. So from that perspective, the government setup was actually fine. What ended up happening was, because the opposition were like, oh, this WE organization is being used, and, you know, potentially there were certain people in the media who had been looking into the WE organization for whatever, you know, personal reasons or other reasons themselves, that these two factors kind of coalesced to create a narrative of, oh, you've given this to WE, so obviously it's because the Prime Minister's buddies with the Kielburgers. But then we find out actually from both the Kielburgers and the Prime Minister that they don't socialize. They're not friends. They only know each other from a professional context. And I can imagine the Prime Minister of the country knows a ton of people, like through his work. His job is literally to be out and about. I mean, even before he was PM as a politician, that was his job, right? Is to like go out there and know what Canadians want and think and all of that. He, as the leader of a political party, that's also his job, you know? So like, it's not at all correct to say that they're friends. It's not at all correct to say this was $1 billion bailout. I mean, there are just so many inaccuracies out there. And really, the media should have been on top of that, because it is so irresponsible that they allowed these kinds of things to continue for as long as they did, and in fact, perpetuate this kind of terminology. At the end of the day, what we have is a huge fallout that's hurt this charity. It's hurt the program, the students, the not-for-profits that would have been involved. And I mean, it's hurt the government too.
So this is an excellent segue into what I was going to ask you about next, and I guess kind of three things: cabinet mm-hmm. machinations, how it works, mm-hmm. recusals, and conflicts perceived and otherwise.
Exactly. I think those are really good questions. So there is a very well-established, long-established way of cabinet decisions being made. So there's a whole process, and it's a dance between the public service and the ministers involved. And what that means is, whenever the government decides, by government, the political side decides that, you know, there's certain types of initiatives that they want to fund, or they think there's a pressing issue on this particular area, they then task the public service with coming up with some solutions. As part of coming up with those solutions, the public servants are required to do a whole host of things. They do consultations, you know, they talk amongst themselves. They sometimes talk to provinces and territories if it requires, you know, cross-jurisdictional implications. So there's a lot of work, a lot of assessments and analysis that goes on the part of the public servants. That's why these things take a minimum of 6 to 8 months usually to come to fruition. So they do a lot of the legwork to try to figure out how to deliver things. Before any decision can be made in cabinet, the public service pulls together what's called a memorandum to cabinet. And this memorandum to cabinet is a very structured document that has been around forever. The requirements within one has evolved over time, but generally speaking, the memorandum to cabinet provides the civil servants recommendations as to how to address whatever the policy issue is at hand. So they will look at, you know, what is the need out there? What are the pros and cons of funding this kind of initiative? What are the risks associated with this initiative? You know, potentially how could it be delivered? What would be the implications across the country, et cetera? What are the recommendations? Usually they come up with three recommendations to go before the government, but sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more. It just depends on the initiative. What we know is that during the pandemic times, they still were following this process. What changed, obviously, is that they didn't have the luxury of the many months they normally did. So I imagine these MCs were probably shorter than they normally would have been. But we do know that they did come up with a recommendation. We learned that in this case, they made the recommendation that either you proceed with the CSSG by using a third-party organization, and in this case, we're recommending it be we, or we don't have any other way of delivering this. Those were the two options that were put forward. Now, whether those were the best ways of putting options forward in this time, I think people can, you know, make up their own minds. But remembering, they're not the ones who did all the due diligence. They're not the ones who knew what the capacity was, what the other options were, what else was going on in government. You know, so like that is what the government was presented with. Like the political side was presented with these two options. That's it. And we learned from Trudeau that initially, when he saw the first iteration and he was being briefed in the beginning, he didn't allow it to go forward in cabinet later that day. He wanted more time, and he was kind of surprised that they weren't going to use the Canada student or the Canada Service Corps. So, you know, he sent it back for more diligence and so on. And then they came back with exactly this binary choice. So that is what the government was presented with. Now, the issue of conflicts, normally it is up to the public office holder, him or herself, to state what their conflicts might be and to be cognizant of whenever they might be put into a situation of a conflict. And when they are in a position of a conflict under the Conflict of Interest Act, they are required to recuse themselves from any decisions that are being made around this entity that, you know, with which they have a conflict. So that's kind of what the requirement is. Now, in terms of whether the Prime Minister and Bill Morneau actually had a conflict, that issue is still being determined by the Ethics Commissioner. That is what the Ethics Commissioner is looking at. You know, to determine that, you know, he'll have to understand what is the nature of the relationships between these various people and the WE organization, and also whether this decision that was made actually gave an opportunity for the private interests of these relatives of these two individuals to have been advanced. And that, you know, to me is not a foregone conclusion. Having said that, based on the Ethics Commissioner's last report relating to Trudeau, I think he takes a very broad interpretation of what constitutes a conflict. He may well find that there was a conflict, but I think that there are actually valid arguments to be made that actually this decision about the Canada Student Service Program or grant would not have advanced the interests of any of these individuals. And especially if I look at the Trudeau case, right? I mean, the fact that the WE organization in the past has, on a contractual basis, invited and paid his mother and brother and so on, that to me, I don't see how that, because it's not like an ongoing relationship. It's not that they have, you know, that this student service program somehow connects with what they talk about or, you know, would give them more opportunities to speak on behalf of. It doesn't, because, I mean, the student grant thing was all about volunteer opportunities for students. It had no speaking component, you know, that could have helped the two speakers in his family, right? So I think from the Trudeau angle, it just, from my perspective, I don't see how there could be an opportunity to have advanced their interests. In terms of his spouse, you know, she volunteers for them. So I don't know what private interests of hers could be further enhanced or advanced through this. On the case of Bill Morneau, they're looking at more than just, you know, the issue of opportunity to further their interests, but because of the issue of the gifts. He took two trips, him and his family took two trips with WE a couple of years ago. He intended to pay for these trips in full. He paid for, you know, certain aspects of the trip, like $50,000 worth, travel arrangements worth. But then there were certain aspects that the Wii people had to accommodate, like had to host them in these. It was one was in Kenya and the other one was in Ecuador. So at their facilities there, and Morneau had intended to pay for it. It just turns out that he didn't end up paying for it. And that was kind of like a mistake, it seems, from the perspective of whoever is responsible for, you know, doing the finances and stuff. But having said that, unfortunately, he's the one who would wear this mistake. So he made that mistake. And that's another aspect that the ethics commissioner is looking at. Because, you know, there are certain provisions in the Conflict of Interest Act regarding receiving gifts. So we have to see, well, did he receive a gift? And then also, was there any private plane rides involved? We don't know, you know, the Wii people are supposed to get back to, the committee on whether there were any. So yeah, anyways, I think, you were trying to interject there for a second.
Okay. I have a few questions. One yeah. is what occurred with Bill Morneau, how is that any different than the disclosures that you see in sponsored travel from MPs? And other office holders in the government of Canada?
So the requirements for public office holders, meaning people who are like ministers, parliamentary secretaries, certain GIC holders, is in addition to whatever is required of regular MPs. So there are certain other requirements, and that's what falls under the Conflict of Interest Act. So I think that's actually a really good point you raise, because these are two separate regimes. There's a code, an ethics code for MPs, which is different, and they have their own obligations and whatever, but they're not as stringent as those for people who are ministers and parliamentary secretaries, as I mentioned, because these guys have way more influence in how government money gets spent and decisions get made and so on. So there does need to be more oversight on people like who are ministers and, you know, which obviously includes the prime minister.
Now, what obligation is Justin Trudeau under to know what his mother is making, who she's making it from? Is there a separate disclosure for family? Because I can't remember the last time I asked my mother how much money she made and where she made it from. I mean, right. depending on, right. on whatever it is I do, that I don't, you know, that being said, I'm not the Prime Minister of Canada, but what obligation is he under to understand what her financial situation or the financial situation of her brother, of his brother is?
Right, exactly. Well, it's not so much, you know, his obligation to know the nitty gritty details of their finances, but rather it's his obligation to know what all of his potential conflicts are. And so he definitely does have to disclose. There's a period, there are all these disclosure requirements under the Conflict of Interest Act. And there's a period within which, after being elected, that you have to do all these disclosures. Now, the Prime Minister has done a very elaborate disclosure thing online, it's to the Ethics Commissioner. So he has already provided, you know, details of all his conflicts as he knows them, but also as he ought to know them too. So I think that's going to be interesting to see in this report that comes out as to whether the Ethics Commissioner noted that he had disclosed appropriately. And you know, even though like the claim here isn't an issue of disclosure, but rather, you know, if in fact he had disclosed that he had this conflict with Wii, and then he just didn't follow through on the other obligations, that okay, once you have these conflicts that have been disclosed, that you then do have an obligation to recuse yourself around decisions regarding this organization, that, you know, whether he breached the act because of that, right? So I think that's where it'll come into play. I mean, the thing is, you know, when it comes to the decision that was brought before cabinet, right? So when this initiative was brought before cabinet, it had already gotten a sign off from cabinet committee. Now, cabinet committee for this particular initiative is the pandemic cabinet committee. It's chaired by the DPM, Chrystia Freeland. Trudeau wasn't there. I think Morneau, I mean, I actually don't know if he was there or not, but in any event, cabinet committee looked at it, and then it came to cabinet for further discussion and approval. And at cabinet, you know, the decision that was supposed, that they were being asked to make, is whether to approve the CSSG, like whether to approve the policy behind this, meaning should we give grants to students for volunteering? Like, that is what was being asked to be approved. They were not asking cabinet to approve, can we use Wii organization? What they were saying is, this is how we'll design it, but the policy that we're asking you to approve is this student service grant issue. And that's what the Prime Minister said in his testimony. So that'll be interesting to see how the Ethics Commissioner uses that, because, you know, if the thing is, if really we was not the decision, like that wasn't what was the decision being put before them, then maybe, you know, this issue of recusal wouldn't have, like, there's no reason that they should have recused themselves. Having said that, I mean, I think that argument, you know, may or may not fly, in part because it does appear that they were told definitively that this is the only way it's going to go. Like, either you pick the CSSG with we as the partner, or we're not doing it at all, right? So it does, like, I think it'll be interesting to see how, you know, the ethics commissioner rules on that. And I think hopefully he'll have access to the memorandum to cabinet. I think he will, if the you know, government provides him with that. And so he can see, like, what was the actual decision they were being asked to make. But keeping in mind that the day, like, the cabinet decision wouldn't have just been on this one initiative. It's like one of a bunch of initiatives, right? So it was one agenda item. And how much into the weeds they went into, I guess, is still, you know, we don't know. And hopefully those are things that the ethics commissioner will look at.
What are the biggest unforced errors in your perception? I mean, in how you see it, that the government made regarding this?
Yeah, I think in terms of the we side of things, like, you know, it would have been nice if both Morneau and Trudeau had thought, I mean, I think especially in the case of Morneau, because his daughter does work, one of his daughters actually is employed by we, or some part of we or whatever, you know, it's a bit, but she is linked with we, you know, even though she personally would not have benefited or whatever, but like, if your child works for the organization, you know, you might want to just not be involved in decisions around that. Mind you, I think the child connection thing has to be like a dependent child or something like that. So, you know, there might be some distinction there. And again, we'll learn more from the ethics commissioner's report as to how he reasons that, you know, this employment of the child gives him conflict or whatever. But, you know, I think it would have been good if both Trudeau and Morneau had recognized that the perception is going to be one of, oh, you're doing favors for this organization with which you have ties. And then that would have led them to recuse themselves. I think that would have made life a lot easier. Now, one of the questions that we did get online about this is, you know, the clerk, Ian Shugart, when he testified, had said that he cannot imagine how the finance minister and the prime minister both could not have been involved in any part of these discussions around the CSSG because of the amounts of money involved. And that I think makes sense. Like, it's true. Like, they needed to be involved in the fact that, you know, this huge amount of money was going to be flowing to this initiative. They needed to talk about whether they wanted to have an initiative like this, where you give grants for to students for volunteering. But what the clerk also said is he's not opining one way or the other. He's not offering any opinion on whether they should have recused themselves from the cabinet discussion. Right. And I see his point, because I actually think there could have been a way that they still could have been involved in the policy decision and the decision about the money, but not had been involved in the discussion, if there was any, or the discussions that there were around which organization to pick. So I think if they had been able to sorry, there was an emergency alert that just came through on my phone. Anyways, so if they had been able to, you know, somehow remove themselves from the discussion around we, that portion of it, then maybe things could have been okay, right? Like, this whole thing could have been avoided, one hopes, because they then would not have been part of it.
I honestly think that had they recused themselves from this, that the opposition still would have spun this that way. I don't think recusal would have even fixed anything regarding this. I think that this, I don't know, you know, I firmly believe that, like you, that they should have recused themselves from the we aspect of it, but not the policy aspect of it. Because, you know, like they say, when media and opposition are looking to turn every molehill into a mountain, don't give them the molehill. And I think that's one of the biggest unforced errors. But as you said, there's no way that the Finance Minister of Canada and the Prime Minister of Canada can sit back and not involve themselves in a $9 billion decision. I think that would have been a dereliction of duty, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, they definitely should have been involved in all the rest of it, for sure. But whether they could have, you know, maybe just not opined on the we part of it, like, maybe that could have just helped the situation. But again, you know, we will need to understand a bit better, what exactly are these links? Like, like, especially with the PM, it's kind of tenuous. Like, it's like, so his, you know, family members at some point had spoken at WE days and at, you know, ancillary events around WE days and so on, but they're not employed by WE. So maybe it just, you know, it made sense that maybe he just didn't think of it. I think too, the other thing, you know, I think we do need to cut him a little bit of slack that this was also in the context of this whole pandemic thing, right? So just as the civil servants and the political staffers were working their 18 to 20 hour days, so were Bill Morneau and the prime minister, right? Like that they have been nonstop going through crisis after crisis. And actually, even before the pandemic hit, you know, this government was dealing with a ton of crises, right? Do you remember like the beginning of 2020? We've had so many things. We had the Iran air crash, right? We had the blockades. We had the Nova Scotia shooting. Like we've had so many things happen in this country in 2020. So they've been, you know, go, go, go for many, many months now. And you know, again, not to say that like, oh, you can just, you know, not pay attention to your obligations under the Conflict of Interest Act or whatever. I'm not saying that, but I'm just saying, let's just try to understand how this happened. And I think the one thing we need to keep in mind is that there is not a shred of evidence that any single person involved or entity involved in this entire affair had any bad faith at all, Like everyone was acting in good faith, from the prime minister to the finance minister. They may have made mistakes, but they were acting in good faith. So were the public servants. So was WE, right? So were all the other organizations that decided that they were going to partner to be part of this organization. So were the students, right? So like, there's no evidence of any bad faith acting on anybody's part here.
Now, how do you see this falling? How do you see the followed, particularly for Bill Morneau? After this, what is this path forward in your opinion?
You know, I think when the dust settles, I mean, right now, I don't think the prime minister is going to be turfing him or anything like that, because we're in the middle of a crisis. We need our finance minister to be doing what he's doing, which is making sure we have, you know, our books in order and that we're funding the programs that we need to, you know, as we navigate this crisis. You know, going forward, it'll be interesting because I think there may be some discord among those in the Liberal Party on, you know, there may be a difference of opinion on who thinks Trudeau should stick around, who thinks Morneau should stick around. You know, there might be some whisper campaigns going on, from what I understand, around, you know, maybe needing Morneau to step aside or whatever. So I think, you know, there may be some challenges ahead for him down the road. Whether that's going to be fair or not, I don't know. But, you know, in part, let's see what happens with the ethics commissioner's reports. Let's see what the fallout is from all of that. And then I think, you know, I think his future is perhaps a little bit more shaky than Trudeau's. And in part because, you know, this mistake that was made with respect to his trips, his personal trips, you know, even though I sincerely believe that it was an oversight, that his intention obviously was to pay for the full trip, like he paid for half of it, the other half, which was the half that was incurred by WE, you know, it should have been paid. He intended to pay it. It just wasn't paid. Whoever was supposed to follow up with it didn't do that. And they only discovered it now because they were obviously doing an audit to make sure as he was about to testify and so on. So, you know, I think that mistake may end up costing him. But whether it's fair, I guess, is, you know, TBD. I do think, though, that both Trudeau and Morneau and the others in government have been doing a great job in responding to the pandemic. I mean, you know, it's just, to me, I feel like from their perspective, they must think it's such a thankless job. You know, like they're go, 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 and like doing all kinds of things to help us through this time. And yet, you know, these potential mistakes that they made are just being so blown out of proportion.
And I think, though, that for Prime Minister Justin Trudeau, where he found Liberal Party in 2013 when he became leader to where they are now and what they've accomplished,
He's
earned the right to make his own decision. And it's funny, you know, you see Andrew Scheer asking him to resign, and I'm thinking, you can't beat him in an election. You can't beat him in a battle of ideas. You can't beat him in a battle of policy. So your only wish is to create the, I guess, the climate in which that he would have to. I think that's wishful thinking. He's not going to resign. He shouldn't have to resign. He can call his own shot when he wants to go.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, it'll be interesting to see it. You know, at the end of the day, I think it'll depend on if he has the confidence of his caucus. And I mean, I haven't heard much on that. I know that I believe it was Chantal Hibert who was saying that, you know, there might be some questions and they probably have better insights into, you know, what liberal MPs are saying. But, you know, it will depend on it'll depend on how the caucus feels. Like I don't think they deserve, you know, all of what's been thrown at them. I mean, certainly in terms of some of the communications around this issue, I think things could have been done a little bit better. But at the same time, you know, it's sort of damned if they do, damned if they don't, because if they're trying to explain things, it comes across as being defensive too, right? So it's kind of like, I think his Trudeau's approach has always been, okay, let me just apologize proactively and see if, you know, that'll put things in the past. And you know, he's apologized. Both of them have.
Okay.
For,
oh, sorry.
These errors. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, no, go ahead. Canadian there. I'm just going to ask you a few things that we've been asked. So basically all political,
yes, on Twitter,
all political parties have been connected to We, but that's been largely ignored by mainstream media, that We is a beloved Canadian charity that is being used as a political pawn. Do you agree with that?
I think so. I mean, I, not knowing all the ins and outs of the We organization, but I know that they've kind of come out swinging as well. And I believe there might be some lawsuits around some of the claims that have been published by certain media people about We. And, you know, if in fact people have been making defamatory statements, meaning untrue statements that have been injurious to We, then yeah, they should sue them. And, you know, there should be accountability on for the media in what they report, that they have to be accurate, they have to be fair, and they have to be balanced. And if they have published defamatory things against this organization, then yeah, they should, you know, they should have to pay for that.
Now, you know, there's a moment that sticks out most for me when I'm looking at, I want to discuss lowlights of this entire process. And one was hearing Charlie Angus reduce Margaret Trudeau to the sum of her husband's name. And that's basically it. And that's how I perceived it to be. And I'm being accused of being a partisan for having said that. But I don't approach everything as a partisan. When I'm watching an interview and I'm watching somebody talk, I think with my critical mind, right? I'll call BS, whether the person's a liberal, conservative, or whatever. And what I heard was that you paid for the name, meaning one, that Margaret Trudeau's for sale, B, that she's nothing but her husband's name, C, that she's trading in on it. And to me, that was the most disgusting moment. And I think you could tell by, you know, I kind of reacted on social media to that. What to you?
Well, a lot of people did not appreciate it. And it's also the Bloc MP Fortin, who was questioning her credentials for speaking about mental health. And it's like, hello, she has lived experience in this. And I actually liked how Craig Kielberger responded, where he said, you know, she's not just somebody's mother or husband or wife. I mean, she's, you know, she's an advocate in her own right. And lived experience when you're talking about mental health issues is really key. And, you know, there've been other people who've come out and said they've heard her speak about her life story and kind of what she's learned from it. It's been very inspirational to a lot of people. And I think that, you know, yeah, there's some misogyny involved there in, you know, trying to reduce her to, you know, the name and trying to discredit what she has to offer. I mean, she's an author who's written about her life, who's written about, you know, how people can address the kinds of challenges that she's lived with. I think, you know, and actually on that note, you know, some people are saying that, oh, well, we only brought her in 2015 to speak once her son was PM. But you know what, even if that were the case, how exactly is that Trudeau's fault? Like, if the organization decided that they want to have this person come and speak on mental health issues, that's their prerogative, right? And they were not getting any quid pro quo here. Like, there was no expectation that they were going to benefit somehow from the government. I mean, think about it. Like, they started, you know, she started speaking after her second book came out, 2015, on with We. That's when she started speaking for them. You know, to think, like, just to me, it's so illogical that 5 years later, right? Like 5 years later, that there would have been this pandemic that, of course, they're going to then like give this huge contract to We. No, like it just doesn't even make sense. Like they started having her come and speak on mental health issues because she was raising her profile on this particular issue, right? And I know she's spoken before and so on, but she did have a number of books, and the one that was out in 2015 was relevant to this topic. And, you know, that might explain the coincidence and the timelines, but it's just to me so implausible that, yeah, and then 5 years later, right, that they would give this program that doesn't even give WE any additional money for themselves. What it does is it only reimburses eligible expenses in delivering this CSSG program.
Now, one thing that bothers me through this is how media looks at certain organizations that, for all the furor that WE is now facing, I wish that WE could see the same kind of transparency into the Fraser Institute, into the Canadian Taxpayers Federation, into Democracy Watch. I think that if we're going to cast this wide light into the machinations of government and those who are involved with government, I think it is time to start looking at some of these third-party organizations, who many of whom claim themselves to be charities, like the Fraser Institute. So I you know what? If we're going to have a reckoning, I think we should have a reckoning everywhere, in my opinion.
Fair. I think that's fair. I just think that, you know, when people go after organizations or individuals or whatever, like, they really need to look at it as to, you know, are they being fair in doing their probe, right? Like, and are they following the facts? Because one of the things that's been really frustrating in this entire discussion in this country is that even as facts were coming out, people weren't accepting it. They were still using their, you know, their ignorant assertions and continuing it. So they're not even listening, and they're not listening to the testimony. So it's, and then they're impugning, you know, the integrity of those who testified. Like, there were things that about, like Pierre Poilievre, he was asking the clerk questions about who is responsible for promoting Rachel Warnick, who's the ESDC civil servant, and kind of implying in his question that, oh, well, if the prime minister is involved, because he did ask specifically, is the prime minister the one who's going to be, you know, doing her next promotion? It's implying that she then would not be testifying truthfully, or that she would have some kind of underlying self-interest in her testimony, which is a completely baseless comment to make. And especially, you know, we had five senior civil servants testify all on the same vein, saying that, they're the ones who did the assessment and they're the ones who decided that WE was the best placed organization, right? So to have these accusations to people's credibility that are completely baseless, you know, to completely ignore the facts that were coming out and still continue with their, you know, ignorant and false assertions, to me suggests that there's more behind this than actually people being interested in fact finding. I think there is an element to this from the opposition, some in the media, you know, to just kind of go after these groups of people just for some other reasons that have nothing to do with actually looking for what happened and the truth.
Well, I think that would be as good of a place as any to end things. I appreciate the fact that you're out there providing facts. You're taking a lot of heat from people inside the media and people who claim to be, you know, disinterested observers of Canadian politics and not to have a political agenda. And I appreciate what you put out there. I appreciate the heat that you take to put your information out there and truth out there. And I know a great many other people do. And it's been an absolute pleasure to podcast with you again, Nishat. I think
likewise.
You know, one more time together, and you're going to get a free hat, you know, the fifth time we've done it together. So, oh, wait, you know what? We should disclose that as a conflict before anything happens. So thank you. And, yeah, hopefully we can speak again and keep...
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. Thank you for giving me the opportunity also to share a bit more of my analysis, because, as you know, I was on CBC the other day, and I'm really grateful that they had me on. And a lot of people were very happy that they had me on as well. But of course, because, you know, TV is shorter, there isn't as much time to get into all the details. But I think unfortunately, a lot of people are misinformed on this. And in part, I think, you know, or in large part, it's because of the way the media has been covering it. So I appreciate having had this additional opportunity to share my thoughts on it.
And I get to say that I knew you before you were a media star. So that's awesome. But thank you, Isha.
All right. Take care.
This has been We've Got Issues from FUN, the FU Network.